This is the IBJ podcast for the week of August 24th, 2020, brought to you by the law firm Craig DeVault. I'm Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. One of the most frustrating things about being a parent during the pandemic, and there are a lot of them, is that medical information we hear about how children are affected by COVID-19 seems to change every week. Maybe a little bit, maybe a lot. It comes in drips and drabs. In particular, it seems like every week there's a new study. Maybe it's based on data from China one week, or South Korea one week, or Iceland the next week. Out of nowhere, we'll hear about a potentially deadly complication. The American Association of Pediatrics has been summarizing all of the publicly available state data every week. And just when I think some of us had become pretty comfortable with the consistently low infection rates for kids, the Academy hit us with news this month that there had been a 90% increase in COVID cases among children in the U.S. over the last 4 weeks. It's a lot to keep track of. And I realized recently I wasn't even sure what I was supposed to do if my four-year-old son started showing symptoms. And as it happens, we were at the pediatrician last Monday for something unrelated, and I noticed parents already were asking about flu shots. And I was like, oh, right, I forgot. This flu season is supposed to be a disaster because of the pandemic, right? Or maybe I thought I heard that. I'm not sure. So now I got to figure that out. Ideally, I think we all would like to sit down with an expert in ideally an unbillable situation and ask our questions. So that's what I did. To get a handle on the latest wisdom concerning kids and COVID-19, and this is on infection rates, mortality, spreading the disease, flu season, playing with friends, going to school, even whether they should wear masks when they're hiking, I spoke with Dr. James Wood. He's a pediatrician who treats patients at Riley Hospital for Children here in Indianapolis. He is an assistant professor of clinical pediatrics at Indiana University School of Medicine, and he is an expert in pediatric infectious diseases. He also has two children, ages 4 and 6, so you know his interest isn't entirely clinical. Not all these questions have clear answers, but I think it's definitely worth a listen. Here's our conversation. I am very pleased to welcome to IBJ Podcast's virtual studio, Dr. James Wood. Thank you so much for making time for us today.
Thanks for having me.
So we got a lot of ground to cover, so I'm going to jump right in. And I first want to define our terms a little more clearly. So when I look at statistics for children, they're often grouped together in a demographic that includes all young people between ages 0 and 18. So for the purposes of our discussion, do we agree that that is what we mean by children? Or are there going to be some significant differences between how like a preteen, 12 and under, would be affected by someone who's a teenage?
Sure. Yeah. I think that in general, when we talk about pediatric patients, at least in my world, we do generally talk about them being 0 to 18 years of age, which is right. I think in our discussion today, there will be some times when we probably should talk about it broken down into that younger age group, the preteens and under, as well as the older kids, because there does seem to be some differences in those age groups as well. So I'll try to point those things out as we go along.
So let me start off with the 30,000 foot view of children in COVID-19, just from what I've been able to glean. According to the American Academy of Pediatrics, children represent 9.1% of all cases in the United States. That's about 400,000 cases out of about 5.5 million cases in the US. And the available data indicates that COVID-19 related hospitalization and death is uncommon, that is their word, uncommon in children. So in Indiana, for example, the percentage of deaths due to COVID-19 is 0.1% for children between the ages of 0 and 19. And in all states that reported data, 0%, about 0.6% of all children, a child COVID-19 cases resulted in death. Does that all sound right?
Yeah, that is about right. You know, obviously all these numbers come with a little bit of a caveat, is they're only as good as the testing we're able to do and things like that. But in general terms, that is, I think that's about right.
And then in addition to all that, at this time, it appears that severe illness due to COVID-19 is rare among children. So my question is, why? Why is this? I mean, our fear at the beginning was, oh, the children are going to be more susceptible because, of course, you know, respiratory diseases hit kids the hardest.
Why do they seem to be less effective than adults?
Yeah, that is a great question. That's kind of a million-dollar question that a lot of people want to know. And I think that I can tell you with any certainty, I can give you some ideas as to why we think that may be the case. As you mentioned, respiratory viruses tend to hit kids the hardest, at least in terms of severity, especially our young kids. Each flu season, you know, we have kind of peaks of which kids are most severely infected. For COVID-19, that doesn't seem to be the case. Kids, younger kids, especially kids under 12 years old, seem to be very much less affected. Some of our older teenagers, 16, 17, 18, they tend to act a little bit more like adults do in terms of severity. But in general, children seem to be less severely affected. Why that is? So we know that people with comorbidities, meaning people with diabetes, hypertension, coronary artery disease, all the obesity, all those things seem to be risk factors for severe disease and COVID. In general, kids have a lot less comorbidity. So that is one thing I think right off the bat that we can say is likely a reason. But even beyond that, we think that a lot of the effects of COVID-19, yes, have to do with the virus itself causing respiratory issues, but a lot may have to do with the way the immune system handles it. So in older people and adults, it seems like the immune system can really do a lot of damage in their lungs and kind of in their coronary arteries and in their blood vessels and things. And in children, they seem to not maybe have quite as much of this respiratory inflammation as adults do, which may be part of the reason why that they are acting differently and not so severely. There are some theories about whether there are receptors within the lung and within the respiratory tract that children have in different quantities that adults have. That may be part of it as well. But I think in general, kids, their immune system seems to act differently than adults. And that seems to be the reason, at least partially, why kids may not be severely affected.
Now, what is multisystem inflammatory syndrome, which is kind of the boogeyman right now for parents? How likely is it that my child will get that?
This was kind of a thing that came out. We started hearing about it in April, and we've continued to hear about it since then. So, right, it is kind of the boogeyman. I maybe demystify it a little bit. It is extremely rare. So, again, we don't know the baseline number of kids that have been exposed to COVID-19 throughout the country or the world, but I can tell you that in general, it is extremely rare. So I think that parents should not be staying up at night worried that this is something that their kid is going to get. That said, I do think it's important for parents to understand what the symptoms are and if they're worried about it, to be in communication with their doctor. So it is a syndrome that seems to be associated with kids that either have active COVID or more commonly have been exposed to COVID in the last 2 to 4 weeks. And these kids are having a whole lot of inflammation in their body that, I guess, for lack of a better term, their immune system is seeing that virus and maybe kind of inappropriately making a lot of inflammation throughout their body and blood vessels. So kids are coming in with fever for, usually it's a prolonged time, but we're seeing kids for anywhere from, you know, a couple days to several days to weeks with fever. A major component seems to be abdominal pain. A lot of the kids that we've seen and a lot of the reports across the country have been abdominal pain is a very severe symptom. Rash, kind of widespread red rash, conjunctivitis, so redness of the eyes, cracked and red lips, as well as hand and foot swelling. So those are things that we see in some of the other inflammation syndromes, and they seem to be common with this MISC syndrome.
Is there an effective treatment for this? Are the kids recovering?
Yeah. So in general, kids are doing very well. They come in pretty sick. They have low blood pressure, and most of them are being admitted to the ICUs. And the vast, vast, vast majority of kids are turning around and getting better fairly quickly, actually. So we don't have a specific treatment targeted at that, but we do have is potent anti-inflammation medicines that we use for a lot of other diseases that seem to work quite well. So we tend to give them just a little bit of medicine, or at least the ICU doctors give them a little bit of medicine to help with their blood pressure. And then along with these anti-inflammation medicines, these kids tend to do quite well.
So if severe illness is rare, what symptoms are we typically seeing in children with COVID?
I think that kids are, they kind of run the gamut of things. I think that fever certainly is one, but it's not, you know, a major symptom. I think that obviously this thing that keeps, I think people keep talking about or seeing is this decreased smell or taste. I think for older kids, that is a symptom that we're seeing. The younger kids might have trouble obviously kind of articulating that or saying what that is, but they may say something about their throat or their nose feels funny. cough and fever. Those are kind of the main symptoms that kids are experiencing.
So here's my fear, that my child is going to wake up with a fever and obviously you kind of look under the weather and I'm going to go, oh my God, what do I do?
I think that the first thing is to take a deep breath, right? We are headed into respiratory season. Kids are going to get fevers for other things. And so I think the first thing is everything that's fever is not going to be COVID. The second thing to realize is that even if it is COVID, right, like we just talked about, kids seem to handle it quite well. So I think the thing to do if your kid is not feeling well, looking ill, do what you would normally do in terms of it's okay to watch them for, you know, the majority of your day, see how they're doing. If they're not improving, I think the real big thing we want to stress is doctor's offices are safe. I know early on, especially, people were avoiding bringing their kids in for routine checks as well as for sick checks. And I understand that because there was a lot of fear. But doctor's offices are doing a lot of safety measures. They're doing a lot of cleaning. And so I really want people to know that it is good and okay to take your kid to the doctor's office. Yeah. Contact your pediatrician. Let them know what's going on and they can help you make that decision.
So if my son has a 102 fever, I'm not bugging my doctor if I call up and say, hey, my child has 102 fever.
No, not at all. They are absolutely expecting that at this point. And I think that, and now let me tell you, I'm not an outpatient pediatrician. I'm an infectious disease specialist. So I'm not the one burdened with these calls, but I will tell you, having spoken with the pediatricians, they are wanting to know and expecting these calls.
Should I just cut out the middleman and go right to the hospital?
No, I think that's another important thing, right? So the one fear or one of the fears, right, is that we're going to overburden the hospital system. Now, if you are seeing things that are, you know, really, really concerning you, of course, like, you know, doing the things you would have done before COVID in terms of the trigger to go to the hospital. But I think that high fever in your child, if calling your doctor first is never wrong. Even if they have COVID, it is not the type of thing where, you know, rushing to the hospital is the answer, because to be honest with you, you're probably going to have to wait a while, you know, potentially there as well. So I would say that, you know, we really want to be activating our emergency rooms when appropriate, but not overburdening them when possible.
All right. Hey, this is pretty good so far. Let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ podcast.
The IBJ podcast is brought to you by Creek DeVault, a trusted and dynamic law firm representing a wide variety of local, regional, and national clients. Committed to each other and to every client, Creek DeVault prides itself on integrity, professionalism, respect, and excellence. Financial institutions, global manufacturers, national healthcare providers, and successful organizations of all sizes and market focus rely on Creek DeVault to create innovative and successful business solutions. Connect today at www.creekdevault.com.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ podcast and my conversation with pediatrician Dr. James Wood about kids and COVID-19.
Even if young children don't seem to be in danger of major illness or dying, are they at risk of serious health problems? Because I think we're beginning to hear stories about how adults who have had COVID cases do end up with some fairly serious, I don't know if chronic is the right word, but you know, some sort of, you know, problems with cognition, you know, long-term problems with their lungs?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because I think that I will tell you that along the way, right, we have been learning about this and we think that we kind of have a handle on what's going on in the short term and then new things pop up. So I would say that we're continuing to learn about this. And of course, nobody has any information right now about long-term side effects or long-term kind of adverse issues that people may have. What I can tell you is that children in general are seemingly not having a severe symptom. So it would stand to reason that they probably are a lot less risk for having long-term effects, but we really don't know that at this point.
Do we have any sense of the percentage of children who have COVID-19, but do not show symptoms?
Yeah, I think that that's probably a lot of kids. That's not a very good answer, but it's probably a lot. I could, giving you a percentage on that would be me throwing out a number that I really didn't, without a lot of evidence, which we're trying not to do. I think that a lot of children probably have either are pre-symptomatic or very mild symptoms. I will tell you that the amount of completely asymptomatic people in general, including children, is probably somewhere around 1%. So a lot of these big studies that we've seen of just population surveys, and actually we just, our group here at Riley Hospital, did a survey in Marion County, and we looked at just completely asymptomatic people. And it seems like completely asymptomatic people, when we swab their nose, the prevalence is somewhere around or just under 1%. Oh. And that is true for kids as well.
Oh, so it's not very many.
Correct. I think that, and I will tell you that that will fluctuate obviously with where you are and time of year, right? So the studies that we have done were early on, especially while lockdown was going on, as people get out more, that number will likely increase. But I don't think that the number, you know, at very early on, we wondered, is the number 20% of people out there that are asymptomatic that have it? I think it's lower than that. But the exact number, I don't know for sure, but I think that it's probably lower than we may think.
The other major prong of this that I think a lot of parents are afraid of is, what do we know about how likely children are to spread COVID-19?
There's been a lot of debate about that. So do kids spread it less than adults? And that seems to be the case, but is that true because kids are exposed less and haven't been getting out as much? Or do they just truly not spread the germ as easily? I think the jury is still out on that a little bit. I will say that it does seem like kids don't tend to spread it, at least in the mass numbers that we've seen in adults. Now, some of that is likely due to the fact that we have kept kids fairly isolated until real recently, out of schools, out of other things. That may be part of it. But so some of it is going to be a behavioral thing, right? We know that a lot of the major spreading events, especially recently, have been adults. And young adults, especially, right, that aren't social distancing, that are trying to go on with their lives. And that is an obvious risk factor for a major spreader event. But whether kids could do that or not at the same rate as adults, it's unknown right now. But it's unlikely, I think, that, you know, that it seems less likely that kids will spread it to the same degree as adults. But again, avoiding these large crowds, especially with kids, would be the right thing to do.
For a lot of parents, I mean, what it boils down to is this question: is my 4-year-old son going to give his 83-year-old grandmother COVID?
That is a really tough one. You know, is that possible? Yes. And so I think that along the way, I feel like since February, March, we as a society, we as a medical profession, have been basically challenged with this, with these risk-benefit ratios, right? Like, what is the risk and what is the benefit? And in each way, each step along the way and each decision we make has to be kind of thought of with that in mind. So can your 4-year-old give your 83-year-old grandmother COVID? Yeah, absolutely. So the question is, what is the benefit of them seeing them? I would say that, unfortunately, if it's possible to keep them separated in a way, I would, because I think that the benefit right now doesn't outweigh the risk. Some scenarios, that's not true. Can they see grandma outdoors and maybe just not crawling on her? Yeah, absolutely. I think that would be okay. You know, can we have our kids seeing our older relatives and older folks or high risk people in an appropriate setting, socially distanced? Absolutely. And I think it's good for everybody's mental health to be able to do that. What I fear and what I don't want to see is people thinking kids are immune or kids don't spread it, and just kind of letting going back to how things were, because I think that we're not there yet.
Yeah, and that's what we're doing at our household. I mean, when we see grandma, it is outside and we take a walk.
Yep, and I think that's exactly right. I mean, don't get me wrong when I say the risk-benefit thing, because I think it's really important. I think seeing our family, seeing our friends in the appropriate setting, taking a walk, you know, being outside. We have my kids will go to grandma and grandpa's house, and yeah, we'll be outside and they'll get to play and they'll get to see them, not quite the same way as they did before, but they still get to see them and be outside with them and kind of socialize with them. And I think that's extremely important.
One thing I wanted to point out about the current data, the very current data that we're getting, at least according to the American Academy of Pediatrics, is that there has been a 90% increase in COVID-19 cases among children in the U.S. over the last 4 weeks. Why is that?
Yeah, and I think that there are a lot of ways to think about that or interpret that. Part of that is increasing our ability to test and access to testing locations. Part of that is kids going back out into certain things, right? So going to camps, going to different social events. That is likely part of it as well. What I don't think it is that all of a sudden COVID is making kids sicker, or more kids are severely affected, or more kids are getting, I don't think it's a change in the virus or a change in the way that kids are handling the virus.
What are maybe the one or two most common misconceptions that you routinely hear about kids and COVID-19?
It's a little bit on both sides of the spectrum of things. The one that I hear a lot is, you know, kids are, quote, immune. And I think that's the wrong word to be thinking about. Kids do seem less severely affected, but to say that they are immune. So when I hear the word immune, I think that they aren't, you know, you don't get it or you're not affected at all. And I think that that's probably the thing that I hear somewhat is, why are we doing all these things? Kids are immune. And so I would say, no, kids are not immune. Kids can certainly get disease. It's rare for them to get severe disease, but that doesn't mean, you know, a small percentage in a large population is more than I want to see. And then the other is kind of on the other side of the coin. We can't go anywhere, touch anything. I think that the amount of anxiety around this virus is understandable, but it's also needs to be taken with a lot of thought. And so I think, especially early on, we didn't know much about virus transmission and spread. So I think a lot of the things that we thought about early on in terms of contact and things, I don't think somebody is going to get it from contacting an outdoor surface. You know, be cautious, wipe things down, wash your hands, of course. But the very hyper anxious or anxiety about getting transmission from contact surfaces, it's been overblown a bit. And I think that we should use a lot of caution and, you know, be rational about what you're doing, wipe things down and wash your hands. But I think that went a little bit overboard in terms of what we know in general about how respiratory viruses spread, including this one.
So what are you expecting from flu season? Do we have any projections at this point?
Yeah. So, you know, obviously each flu season is a little bit different. We try to use the Southern Hemisphere as much as we can. So where it is actively circulating now, to guide us a little bit, to get an idea of what we might expect. It's not always the case, right? Sometimes our experience in the US and in the Northern Hemisphere is different than theirs. With that in mind, I think that what we are seeing, at least from there, and maybe some hopeful signs, is that a lot of the social distancing and a lot of the strategies that we're using for COVID are actually helping reduce the amount of flu that is being seen in those areas. And so we're hopeful that may also be true here, right? Really good hand washing, social distancing, masks, all those things likely will help contain the flu, or at least keep the numbers hopefully lower this year than they've been as well.
I think we kind of had this idea, at least from a few months ago, that when flu season hits, it was going to sort of compound the problem with the pandemic, that it was going to be sort of a monstrous problem for us to handle. Is that still the thinking or the case, and why would that be?
The two things that we kind of know or think about are, if somebody gets co-infected with flu and COVID or multiple viruses at a time, are they at higher risk? Potentially, you know, we do know that right now people have been co-infected with COVID as well as other viruses, and there's not a clear signal to say these people are at super high risk for getting severe disease. Co-infection with viruses before COVID, we've seen this before. And especially in younger in kids, they can have multiple infections and multiple viral infections. And so, how does that put them at risk for more severe disease? I think we don't know that quite yet, but certainly there hasn't been a strong signal that that is the case. Probably the bigger issue or the concern is people are going to start having a lot of symptoms: fever, runny nose, cough, that look a lot like COVID. How are we going to distinguish that and handle that? And I think that certainly, honestly, is going to be a challenge. We are going to have to be doing a lot of testing. And then I think that, you know, we're getting to the point where testing is improving. So I think that as we are able to rapidly test, we can hopefully mitigate some of that. So, right, if somebody has a cough, fever, runny nose, again, calling the doctor, finding out what's going on, getting tested, is a good thing.
Here's a question for which you have a few hundred caveats, but it's the question of the month. Is it safe to send my kids to school?
That is the hot button question right now. And there is not a one size fits all answer for this, for sure. I think that from a global perspective, we all as pediatricians, and I think parents a lot, recognize that school is a lot, it has a lot more to do with just education, right? There's this social interaction. There's a mental health aspect. There is food security and safety in school. So there's a huge number of factors. And that's just the children. That doesn't even take into account things that the staff and other folks at the school, teachers, have to encounter and deal with. So the question is, do we, you know, what is safe and what is not? And I think a lot has to do with your particular community, what the numbers look like in that area, and what the resources of your school are. So I think that in an area where the community prevalence is fairly low, what is that number? I don't have a magic number, but what is that? Where your prevalence is pretty low, where you're able to put in, or the school is able to implement strategies in terms of keeping desks at least 3 feet, if not 6 feet away, cohorting kids, not doing things outside as much as possible, mandating masks in schools, all those things. I think if we do all those things, you know, school can go back and at least attempt it. Because I think the goal needs to be to get back to in-person classes. That does not mean that every single school should be going back to in-person classes. But I think that there are ways that we can try to attempt to do this safely. You know, it takes a lot of planning and resources. And I would say that if those things aren't met, then I would not want to go back to school. But I do think that it is important to get back into in-person classes as quickly and as safely as possible. But there certainly needs to be safeguards.
If you don't mind me asking, you have at least one child?
I have two young kids. Yep.
Okay. How old are they?
4 and 6.
So what are their plans for going to school?
Yeah. So right now, my 4-year-old is actually back in pre-K. She attends that 3 days a week. And my 6-year-old is currently in virtual learning right now.
Are you okay with them going back to school?
I would, and I will tell you again, like my circumstances are such that like as a family, we've decided and kind of, we don't have a whole lot of high risk individuals. We've decided that we would be okay letting our kid go to school. It is a personal decision. So from a public perspective and from a big, you know, overarching policy decision makings, the things I mentioned before, I think are accurate. But when it boils down to things, people have to make their own personal choices.
Are there any health risks that we should be aware of for virtual school? I mean, the one that pops to mind, obviously, is screen time, but maybe there are others.
In terms of just virtual school itself, right? I mean, kind of screen time and just that lack of social interaction, I think, is a big deal. You know, I've heard stories of especially teenagers who are battling things like depression or battling mental health illness. Some people have said going to school actually was harder for them. Others have said that staying home and socially isolating has been really, really challenging. And so I think that understanding that everybody's situation is different, but certainly kind of the mental health aspect of things. And I kind of alluded to this before, but you know, one of the things I really worry about is food insecurity for folks, as well as safety of our kids. And so I know our school counselors and our teachers are a lot of times the first people that are picking up things like child abuse and other types of neglect and abuse. And that worries me. As people stay home, I think that there's already evidence that these numbers may be increasing. And that does worry me, that kids aren't getting the kind of supervision or the kind of the guidance that they need.
One of the common threads when I talk to people about this, people seem to be concerned about like what is allowable in terms of playing with friends. You know, some people mention, well, you know, I've got, my child has 3 or 4 kids that he hangs around with, and we try to limit it to that. People aren't really sure about play dates. Are play dates still okay? Should they be inside? Should they be outside?
Yeah, I think that, again, this is one of those... a little bit less scientific and a little bit more just what are we feeling and doing. Again, kids need to socialize, and the idea that we're going to be able to keep, like for instance, my 6-year-old, we told them, you know, we can go play with another family. They've been responsible in terms of how they've approached things. Let's just try to keep our distance. And the first thing the 2 6-year-old did was run up and hug each other. So those things are going to happen. We can't freak out about those types of things. They're kids. These are going to happen. So do I think it's okay for a small number of people and kids to have play dates? I do. Again, especially if we can do it outside, if we can have them riding bikes together, if you can do things that are, you know, just outdoor activities, get them to be able to socialize and get back to being kids a little bit, I think it goes a long way and helps a heck of a lot.
We have there's a kid who lives down the street from us who also attends preschool with our son. So we've decided, you know, they're around each other during the week. You know, they should be able to hang out on the weekend. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think that kind of goes back to, or that goes to and speaks to these little pods or cohorts of people that we hang out with. And so one of the things that if somebody gets it is, okay, how do we quote contact trace, or how do we follow all the people that they've been in contact with? Well, if you are able to see and hang out with a smaller group of people that tend to cohort together, I think that's totally reasonable, especially when kids are in school together or in daycare or preschool together.
I got one more for you. Hiking. When I asked people about, or I told people I was going to speak with a pediatrician about this, a lot of people asked me about hiking.
Yeah.
Let's say you're at Eagle Creek, you know, the trails can be kind of narrow. Nobody wants to wear a mask when they're hiking. So you're passing some other family on the trail. Is that okay?
That is a low risk scenario. When we talk about close contact, you know, when people seemingly are getting this, it's in close contact. And what does that mean? That's within 6 feet for 15 minutes. That's kind of the definition, if you will. Right. Could you get it from other, less than 15 minutes? Sure. But hiking, passing somebody on a hiking trail, short of them sneezing or coughing directly on you, is a very low risk scenario. And so if there's a trailhead or something where a lot of people are congregating or having to get on the trail at one point, yeah, I would probably mask up, you know, while you're unable to keep a little bit of distance. But boy, passing somebody on an outdoor trail doesn't seem like a high risk scenario to me. And I wouldn't be too worried about the mask.
That's wonderful. I personally am glad to hear that. Well, I know you're super busy. I'll let you get back to the business of taking care of people, but I really appreciate your time.
Sure. Appreciate it as well. Thanks for having me.
My thanks again to Dr. James Wood. Before you get on with the rest of your week, I want to draw your attention to a few stories in the latest print edition of IBJ of direct relevance to our conversation today. Anthony Shutley explains how some school districts are trying to make bus travel safer. Indianapolis-based tech firm Synovia Solutions began working this spring on a new platform that helps with contact tracing and hygiene verification on school buses. It already has signed on more than 250 districts. Also in this week's issue, John Russell explains why health insurers, such as Indianapolis-based Anthem, are reporting huge boosts in earnings in the second quarter. But the windfalls are raising protests from doctors, hospitals, and patients. And Sam Quinn explains how the 350,000 immigrants in Indiana have become especially vulnerable to COVID-19, not just for health reasons, but also economic. Again, you can read these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or, of course, online at IBJ.com. I will say it's a lot easier to access all of IBJ's award-winning business content if you have a subscription. It works out to about $2 per week, which is pretty good for the amount of information that can help you make important decisions here in the next few months. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.